Committee on Healthcare for March 15th, 2013, and announce first we're going to carry over House Bill 2969 to Monday and House Bill 2132 also till Monday. I think here's the plan. I think we have one brief bill we want to handle first, and then we'll introduce the PBM bill for a couple of introductions. We'll ask the sponsors, and we'll ask Representative Smith to come to introduce one person. Then I think we'll close that bill and go to the midwife bill.
Be last.
All right, wait a minute. I'm going to open a public hearing on on House Bill 2128 and invite Mr. Black to testify. Will you tell us what this bill does, Mr. Administrator? I remembered to ask you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2128 requires the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation and Oregon Educators Benefit Board to reach agreement on plans offered through the exchange to educators, and requires that the same rate applies to plans offered by the board outside of exchange as identical plan offered through the exchange.
Mr. Black, go to
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, my name is Justin Black. I'm from the Oregon Education Association, here to speak in support of House Bill 2128 and the amendment that I believe you all have on it. And I will talk about both together. Last session, you all passed the exchange bill that created Cover Oregon. In that, there was an option for school districts to be able to purchase health care through the exchange starting in 2015. There was not a lot of detail on how that was all supposed to work. So House Bill 2128 is to help define how that interaction happens and how plans are selected. It follows the federal model of requiring the same plans to be offered in the exchange as outside by requiring the same plans to be in the exchange that are in OEB, requiring the boards to mutually agree on those plans. Where it differs and where the amendment comes in is that it will keep the risk pool together for OEB so that we don't have to worry about adverse selection of people hopping off and on and creating that problem. But what it does allow is for the exchange and OEB to charge their own administrative rates, even if they are different, so that whichever system is more efficient, we have a good comparisons of plan design, risk pool, and that things can be done on the administrative rate to bring efficiencies down or bring efficiencies so that we have an apples-to-apples comparison on whichever plan costs the less or costs the least. That is the rundown of the bill, and that's what it does.
And my understanding is the exchange isn't opposing this bill, but they're nervous about getting an absolute deadline on it, and their hope is that they'll have a chance to work it out once they get.
Yeah, Chair Greenlee, members problems. Of the committee, and talking with the exchange, I think they have expressed to me that the 2015 deadline that's already in statute, that is not a part of this bill, they are worried about how quickly that is coming up on them and how there is nothing in statute in this bill or in the original statute that gives them a way to pay to create the structure for school districts to use. So they are concerned about the timeline and how to pay for this. This bill has nothing to do with that. I think we have expressed an interest to work with them on the timeline and how to pay for it, either through any number of means.
Any number of ways.
Any number of ways, yeah.
Are there any questions? I think we're going to be ready to move this bill if nobody has a problem with it. Is there any questions?
I had a question, Mr.
Please,
Chair.
Please, go ahead.
And we talked before, which I appreciate you seeking me out, and but I couldn't remember if we talked about or if I asked you. Doesn't a plan that's offered inside the exchange already have to be priced the same outside the exchange?
Representative Connor Chair Greenlich. That is how the exchange works currently on plans that are subsidized by the feds. That's the kind of the why we have to do a different cost for plans inside the exchange and outside the exchange for OEB is that there's no federal money to subsidize them getting the system up and running. So they may have to initially charge a little bit more to create the whatever structure they need to allow districts to buy into it. So we're a little concerned that if they have to charge a little extra on the exchange side to implement this, we don't want to raise costs on the OEB side to compensate for that. So by giving them the ability to have different admin rates and charge different prices, that'll even out.
I don't think I followed you. Okay. So my question was, currently, my understanding is if a provider lists a plan in other than small groups, which this wouldn't be. I guess some schools maybe would be, but it's small minority. We're really talking about the whole system-wide school districts. So setting that aside, if a insurer lists a plan, offers it in the exchange, that same plan offered outside has to be priced the same. And I thought I heard you saying that one of the reasons for this was to make sure that OEB was offering the same price in inside and outside the exchange. I just don't understand why that would be necessary.
Congressman Chair Greenlich, you're absolutely right on the way the exchange is structured right now. They have to charge the same inside the exchange as outside the exchange. The amendment to the bill removes that requirement for school districts so that if one entity is able to charge less, they will be able to charge less.
I see.
And so there will be, our hope is that this will create some competition between OEB and the exchange and that we can bring down costs.
And this is a separate corridor of the exchange. It has a different set of regulations.
And may I just, I think now I understand what you're saying is that because the development of the OEB part of the exchange or the, and I don't know why you need a separate part of the exchange for teachers than you do for commercial insurance generally. So I guess that I don't understand. But I think what you're saying is there's no subsidy, so you believe that the exchange will have to build in something to the cost of offering OEB or offering teachers plans on the exchange, and you want to make sure that you don't have OEB doesn't have to price the same outside because of that. I kind of get that. I guess one last follow up, Mr. Chair, on this, if I may. It strikes me that anybody who comes onto the system, say a small group or anything else, the exchange has to develop whatever representation for the, you know, whatever process to get them in the plan or to get them listed on the exchange. I'm not sure that's the right word, but available. And there's a cost associated with that in the future, no matter what. May not be as big as dealing with, you know, the school system, but that could also be spread over a lot more. And then the exchange is capped on what it can charge for as a, you know, an add-on on the premium that's offered by the insurer. So why is this different, and why doesn't OEB fall under that system or that limitation?
Representative Conger, Chair Greenlich.
I'm going to make a suggestion.
Sure.
I'm going to close the public hearing and ask you to check in with Representative Conger between now and next week. We'll bring it back next week for a work session.
That's absolutely fine with me. I didn't mean to hold this up.
No,
and I apologize because he did come to me. I just didn't have these questions.
And you may want to talk to the exchange people as well.
Sure.
About this, or maybe together.
Thank you.
So it'll be useful.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Just one other question. School Boards Association, have they taken a stand on the bill?
Representative Kenner, Chairman, like, not that I know of.
We haven't heard one. I haven't heard. I'm going to close the public hearing. We're going to carry this bill over to Monday for a work session. And if we're ready to go, we'll move it quickly Monday. If not, we'll take as much time as we need to make sure everybody's comfortable. And you may want to talk to the exchange committee. Their point is they're going to have to wait a while to do this. So. Okay. I'm going to open a work session. I'm sorry, a public hearing on the PBM bill.
Yeah, 2123.
On 2123. And I'll ask Representative Bailey, Representative Smith, and Representative Smith, you want to bring along a constituent?
For sure.
And will you tell us what this one's about, Mr. Administrator? And then we'll ask Representative Bailey to tell us about it as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2123 requires the State Board of Pharmacy to license pharmacy benefit managers, imposes limits on audits of pharmacies by pharmacy benefit managers, insurers, and state agencies.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42. Thank you so much for taking time to hear this bill and this issue again. Those of you that were on the committee last session may remember the issue of pharmacy benefit management companies coming before your committee. And at that time, we recognized a problem and had proposed a start of a conversation about a solution. This committee and I think we deemed that that solution that we proposed in the last session was not the right solution, and the chair and Representative Thompson, I think, made the decision to move this to a work group in the interim. We convened several meetings of that work group throughout this summer. We had wide-ranging participation in that work group, and through the course of that work group, really had the chance to drill in on what the real issues are and what the potential solutions to those issues are. And I'm grateful to all the people that took the time during the interim to participate in that work group. And as the work group process started to draw to a close, and I think we were reaching relative agreement amongst the members of about where we were headed with that work group process, unfortunately, the pharmacy benefit management companies chose to walk away from the table at that time. But we have continued to work on this issue, and I think have brought a bill before you that is a fair bill that addresses the issues that are most critical to address at this time and are really modeled on what other states have done. So I want to walk you very briefly through some of the additional background. Pharmacy benefit management companies are an important entity in our healthcare system, and I want to be very clear about that. They are an important entity in our healthcare system. The classic model of a PBM, not every PBM follows this model, but it's an entity that lives essentially between your insurance provider and your pharmacist that helps regulate and provide access to pharmaceuticals and to do the reimbursement of costs back to pharmacies. The problem is that as you have a few of these that have become quite large and quite powerful and are essentially a relatively new entity really only coming into full prominence in the last couple of decades, there is an issue where they have started to use their market power to really come down hard on and abuse small local pharmacies that is threatening to run them out of business. And many other states, in fact, it's fair to say that at least 37 other states have some form of pharmacy benefit management regulation. There are many states that have many of the provisions that we are talking about here. In fact, the audits provision that I'll talk about shortly was modeled after several states, including Utah, that passed provisions related to these. Mississippi has a similar registration mechanism. And just this session, North Dakota passed 93-0 MAC pricing provision that will be essentially the same as what is in this bill. Kentucky has signed it into law, Oklahoma is signing into law, and Montana is also proceeding down this path. So Oregon is really the outlier. I think we sometimes say around here that Oregon loves to be first or last. In this case, I think we're bringing up the rear. But it's time to change that because it's really important for a couple of issues, most importantly for issues of access and safety. You'll hear more about the access issue from my fellow panelists. They can describe it much more eloquently than I can and the impact that it has in a rural district. I will say even for an urban district like mine, it's a really important issue. Often there might be only one or two 24-hour pharmacies in a given area of town. And my wife, who's a pediatrician, has expressed to me her concern that if you had a patient that was being sent home in the middle of the night from the emergency room, needed to pick up emergency antibiotics to get started on those, and is from a low-income family, and there either isn't a 24-hour pharmacy that's available, or that, or they go to a 24-hour pharmacy and find out because of some contract dispute with a PBM, they have to pay full price for that medication. That may mean that the family only buys a smaller portion of the pills or starts cutting pills in half. It makes it very dangerous from an access perspective if pharmacies aren't able to provide efficient services to their customers. This also ends up resulting in what's essentially a hidden tax. While the actions of the PBMs can have a major consequence on smaller local pharmacies and rural pharmacies, even with larger pharmacies that may have the market power to be able to negotiate with a PBM, if they're taking a hit on unfair audit practices or MAC pricing practices and losing money through their pharmacy department, they have to make up those costs elsewhere. And that means raising prices in the rest of the store to offset the losses that are there. So we're all paying for this, whether or not we've had a direct issue with a PBM. The bill before you, you have one more amendment that is coming. That will be an inclusive amendment. You have a couple of amendments that are here.
You have a dash 1, a dash 2, and a dash 3.
Correct, Mr.
Chair. Are they
all
yours?
They are. And the dash 2s and dash 3s are more of a technical nature and will be included in the final amendment. It will look substantively like the dash 1s in terms of issues addressed. The MAC pricing provisions in the dash 1s will be modeled now after the laws that are passing in other parts of the country to make sure that we have some consistency there with what other states are doing. But the bill is really intended to do three things. One, we're just asking for some basic registration. We're not asking for them to disclose their books. We're not asking for them to turn over secret information. This is a name and a phone number, right? It can be very difficult for pharmacies to be able to understand how to get a hold of a PBM without going to their public website and calling their consumer protection line when they've, or their consumer service line when they have an issue. We just want to know who's doing business in the state of Oregon, how to get a hold of them. Two, audit protections to make sure that while it is absolutely acceptable for a pharmacy benefit management company to do audits when there are cases of fraud or other illegal activity, we want to make sure that they aren't blowing small typographical errors out of proportion and punishing pharmacies for otherwise innocent mistakes and then trying to shut them down for what is essentially just a paperwork error. And then third, on MAC pricing, not asking them to do anything more than just making clear what the policies are, communicating the information, having some timeliness there, and not changing the rules of the game after a drug has gone out the door to make sure that people who are owning a small business can operate with the same kind of certainty that any other small business operates with when they sell something out the door. And with that, I pause there and turn it over to people who are much more eloquent than I am. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you very much. Thanks for your work on this, both you and Representative Thompson. This has not been an easy trail. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, for the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of representing portions of Umatilla County, Morrow County, Gillam County, Sherman County, and what I like to say are the best parts of Wasco County, which means what that means is I'll never be running for the Senate. First of all, I want to say, Mr. Chair, how much I appreciate you allowing this bill to be heard. And I want to thank the phenomenal work of Representative Bailey. Representative, I want you to know rural Eastern Oregon appreciates you. So thank you. And I want to represent the great work of Representative Thompson. And I want you to know we appreciate you.
You better be careful. He might move to your district and run against.
What I want to share with you just very quickly is I want to just paint a picture. Representative Bailey eloquently shared with you what the bill does. I want to put a little bit of emotion and a little bit of a human face on why this bill is important. Where I come from, I live in remote and frontier Oregon. As a matter of fact, I live in a community to where I go grocery shopping in my community, but when it's time to do the big grocery shopping, I'm driving 110 miles to go to Costco.
For folks in other parts of my district, they're driving upwards of 140 miles. For other parts, and those are the folks who came to sing yesterday, those kids, just to put a perspective on it, they drove over 260 miles to come to the state capitol. And so we're out in frontier rural Oregon. In our communities, there's three things that we need. One is we need good, viable schools. Second, we need good roads, good transportation, good infrastructure. And the third is we need good, viable access to health care. And the lady sitting next to me here is a friend of mine. She's my neighbor. She's a constituent of mine. And her name is Anne Murray. And in a moment, I'm going to introduce her to you because she is the face of health care in much of Northeast Oregon and North Central Oregon. What I want to share with you is just a personal story very quickly. My youngest son is a type 1 diabetic. And as you can imagine with a type 1 diabetic who's a youngster, an early teenager, quite often there's medical complications. And quite often you're dealing with medications that have to be mixed. Quite often you're dealing with medications that have to be taken in a very timely manner. On several occasions, my son, who has fallen ill, has needed the direct assistance of my neighbor, Ann Murray. And on numerous occasions, from 11 o'clock at night to 5 a.m. on a Sunday morning, Ann and her husband, John, have stepped up and assisted my family. Now, I want you to know, we appreciate that, and that's special. But Ann's not doing that special for me. Ann does that for everyone in Heppner and South Morrow County. Ann also does that for folks in Condon, in Fossil, in Spray, in Arlington, in Morrow, in Grass Valley. She does it for folks in John Day. She does it for folks in Kimberly. She does it for folks in Prairie City. And what I'm trying to share with you is it's so important that we step up when we support our rural pharmacies. And the reason I'm here to support House Bill 2123 is because I'm worried that the PBMs are squeezing out our small rural pharmacists. And I'm asking you folks to step up and to assist Representative Bailey in his effort in helping rural Oregon. It's not very often I testify on bills. Matter of fact, it's not very often I speak on the House floor. What I would share with you is I look at the needs of rural Eastern Oregon. This is probably one of the top three issues that we need to address to sustain and support rural Eastern Oregon's economy in providing reliable and viable health care in Eastern Oregon. So, Mr. Chair, thank you so much for letting me share my thoughts on this. I appreciate your leadership. And if I may, I'd like to introduce Ann Murray, a local small business owner, one heck of a good neighbor, and a pharmacist who serves North Central and Northeast Oregon.
Ms. Murray, we're going to have to impose on you the same limits on the other testifiers. They will have 2 minutes, please, and when this goes yellow, it'll be 30 seconds. And I also, when I visited your community for the committee once, I got to have a very delightful dinner with your mother-in-law.
That's right. Thank you.
Filled my ear full.
Thank you, Greg. And we're very lucky that he goes above and beyond to represent Eastern Oregon. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair Greenlick and committee members, my name is Ann Murray. I'm a pharmacist from Heppner, Oregon. Our family business, Murray Drug, has stores in Heppner, Condon, and Prairie City. We have served Eastern Oregon since 1959 with three generations of pharmacists. We have a son and daughter currently in pharmacy school. We serve South Morrow, East Grant, all of Gillam, and Wheeler counties as the only local pharmacy provider. This equates to over 5,000 square miles of rural Eastern Oregon, involving a population of about 15,000. We are passionate about quality services, know how to provide them, and care about the quality of our profession. I recently spent last summer and fall working on the work group for this legislation. I'm providing testimony in support of House of 2123 to show how certain PBM practices have put the viability of all pharmacies, both rural and urban, at risk. The emergence of PBMs a couple decades ago added a very expensive layer of bureaucracy, which is only found in the United States. In 2002, an article called Evolution of a Hurricane predicted what would happen if PBMs became more powerful and how this middleman layer would increase the cost of health care, and I submitted this article with my written testimony. This prediction has come true. Instead of lowering premiums and reducing costs, PBMs have continually reduced payments to the providers actually providing the service while not showing insurers what the pharmacies are being paid, effectively and profitably keeping the difference. This lack of transparency is an issue that needs to be addressed in Oregon, as several states already have. According to Forbes.com, on their list of 2012 highest-paid CEOs of the top 100, Express Scripts CEO came in at number 6, taking in $51.5 million last year. The issue I'm addressing today is why 2123 is needed to protect access to local pharmaceutical care. The playing field is not level right now. We're being squeezed to the breaking point by PBMs. Take it or leave it contracts, way below our cost of dispensing. And with MAX, which will be explained later, maximum allowable cost, we don't know what we're going to be paid on generics, which is 87% of what we dispense. We only know after we've dispensed the prescription how much money we have lost. I had a couple examples of payments, but anyway, looks like I'm getting it. The bottom line is access. If community pharmacies go out of business, you will not have access to important time-sensitive medications. PBMs may not want to have light shined on their highly profitable business practices. Other states have implemented legislation for a more level playing field and better access to local service. Oregon has a chance to do the same. I respectfully ask that you support 2123 to address these issues. Thank you.
Ms. Murray, thank you very much. Thank you all. We'll have lots of chance to ask people questions, but anybody? Thank you. Thanks for coming
down. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to call two other folks who come from way away. That's Matt DiLoretto and Michelle Belcher, and I'll ask Shelley Bailey to join that panel as well, a panel supporting the bill. We'll alternate support and opposition as long as we have any of either of them left. Any one of you?
I'm up first. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Matt DiLoretto. I'm the Director of State Government Affairs for the National Community Pharmacists Association. I know time is brief, so I'll get right into the issues that this bill addresses. First off, NCPA supports this legislation, has been involved in its discussion since early on. We believe the PBMs fall under the purview of the State Board of Pharmacy for a simple reason. These entities have access to patient information. They dispense medications through their mail order pharmacies. And also, they develop the contracts, the medication contracts that pharmacies must follow. And by their own mission statement, let me read it here, the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy is here to promote, preserve, and protect the public health, safety, and welfare by ensuring high standards in the practice and by regulating the quality, manufacture, sale, and distribution of drugs. By that own definition, PBMs are correctly put under the purview of the State Board of Pharmacy. The second provisions, as Representative Bailey stated, 23 states currently have fair and uniform pharmacy audit provisions on the books. We're expecting to increase that to 24 states literally within the, hopefully, the next week or so. And the provisions that are inside the Oregon language that you see before, the amendment language that you will see before you, they go above and beyond what any other state has done to clearly define that when fraud, abuse, and financial loss exist, we support the need for audits to recoup money. The reality of the situation is these clerical errors are targeted that don't have any financial harm, abuse, or ill intent. For example, a pharmacist was audited for $14,000 because his insurance company told him to use a nurse practitioner's number instead of a physician's number, and when the auditor showed up, $14,000 audit, he had to settle that for $12,000, even though he was doing exactly what he said. The MAC provisions in this legislation as well, Kentucky did send their bill to bill to the governor. There is a national trend going, and the language you see in this bill is, you know, very similar to those. Oklahoma is moving legislation. North Dakota has a very good bill that is also strongly supported. I will let the pharmacists get into the details of the MAC, but we ask for your support.
Thank you. Ms. Belcher?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and representatives. My name is Michelle Belcher. I'm a second-generation pharmacist and owner of Grants Pass Pharmacy in Grants Pass. I'm also the second vice president of the National Community Pharmacists Association. I'm here to not only speak in support of this bill on behalf of myself as an independent community pharmacist and pharmacy owner, but also on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. In a world where the delivery of effective health, effective patient care is king, as it should be, Oregon's local community pharmacists are getting the squeeze, and it is time that we address this. We have many of my colleagues that are facing the potential of closing their pharmacies, and it's something that we must address now. Over 90% of a community pharmacy's income is from prescription drug sales. So in terms of a cost shift to where you can make up your profit, that is not an option. Over 90% of prescriptions are paid by the PBMs, to put that in perspective. These PBMs are the most profitable segment of the healthcare system and have seen over 1,000% increase in price share over the last 10 years. Currently, there is no standard regarding the criteria for the inclusion of drugs on the MAC list or for the methodology on how that price is established, changed, or updated. In many cases, this list remains confidential to both the plan payer and also the pharmacy. And obviously, this leaves us unsure as to what we will be reimbursed until the time we fill that prescription. Then, it is possible for the plan to mark up it's possible for the PBM to mark up what they're charged to the plan. And this may many times show a huge disparity between what has been paid to the pharmacy. The complexity,
wrap up, please.
Yes. The complexity is not a good reason for non-disclosure. And if we do not keep track of all of these MACs, how can they bill the plan sponsor accurately? Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Chair Greenlick and members of the House Health Committee, for the record, my name is Shelley Bailey, and my partner and myself own Central Drugs Pharmacy, a 110-year-old independent retail pharmacy in the heart of downtown Portland. Our mission over the last 10 years or more has really been on serving individuals living with HIV. We're the largest provider in the state providing these services, and we're also a critical kind of source of information for individuals living with this condition. Today I'm here to testify regarding the need for legislation that relates to maximum allowable cost, as well as provide a little bit of context relating to behaviors exhibited by PBMs during audits. So I think the best way to kind of convey the maximum allowable cost issue is through an example. So for an example, for a prescription that Central Drugs filled in December of 2012, we received $8 and I think 60 cents in total reimbursement. For that same prescription, for the same patient, for the same insurer, in January of 2013, we were paid $1.60 by the new PBM that the insurer chose to partner with. So should indiscriminate and non-transparent MAC pricing by the PBMs be continued to be allowed, Central Drugs will be forced to close our doors. Currently, we serve over 1,500 Oregonians, and so these Oregonians would experience disruptive access to health care should our pharmacy close. Another point of reference, 660 of the Oregonians we serve receive care through the coordinated care organizations, and right now, some of the behaviors exhibited by the CCOs are among the worst that we're experiencing. So I really want to highlight MAC and some of the things you might hear with respect to MAC. MAC transparency will not lead to elevating prices for insurers or payers. PBMs use MAC to kind of manage their generic effective rates with their PBM partners. So with their health plan partners. So PBMs are able to, if they're able to pay less than what they've agreed to with the insurers to the pharmacies, they are able to keep that spread. So it's that spread that's kind of the impetus for why everyone's concerned about this today. The other point I wanted to reference was related to audits. We were audited for $48,000 by one of the PBMs in the room today because they claimed our pharmacists did not sign the prescriptions. So I certainly welcome questions, and I would like to discuss this further, but again, we won that audit, but it took me over 200 hours to fight the PBM just to keep the money that we had been paid for the drugs we sold. So I hope that you will be able to review this proposed legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I call a panel in opposition? Sean Karbowitz, Cindy Baubecker? Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
And Peter Hardy. Oh, yes, sir.
Are we going to be able to do any questions, you think?
Yeah, if you...
Okay.
Yeah, ask okay. questions. And we're going to do a public hearing. When we work the bill, the other thing we can do is find out who we need to get back to get further in depth. We'll do that. Schedule that on a different day.
Thank you.
We've got two high-intensity public hearings today.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it.
Okay. Good afternoon, Representative, our Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm Sean Karbowitz. I'm a pharmacist, and I'm appearing on behalf of RegionsRx. RegionsRx is a pharmacy benefit manager based in Portland, Oregon, that serves Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield, the not-for-profit Oregon health plan. I urge you to vote no on House Bill 2123. The MAC pricing provisions in House Bill 2123 will adversely affect any health plan that uses a PBM to manage their drug costs, or for that matter, any company that uses that manages a drug benefit. This includes the state prescription drug plan, employer plans, union plans, workman's comp, etc. MAC pricing is used in every state of the country and incentivizes pharmacies to use judicious purchasing practices and manage their inventory when they're purchasing generic medications. It's a tool that ensures that employers that we serve and their employees get the most competitive market-based prices. House Bill 2123 does not benefit the consumer or the patient. It allows pharmacies to purchase generic drugs at competitive prices and then be reimbursed at significantly higher rates. In fact, one way that I read the bill is there's a tighter definition of what could be MAC'd, or what could have be subject to a MAC price, and a much broader definition of generic in Oregon statute that a pharmacist can dispense. So it effectively excludes medications that should be and could be MAC'd. So with that, I'll take any questions.
This bill simply requires the PBMs to let the pharmacist know what the price is. It doesn't affect the price of anybody, does it?
So the bill, as I read the bill, and apparently there's been a number of amendments lately, and I might not have seen all the amendments.
There'll be another one.
And there probably will be. My understanding of what the definition of what can be MAC'd is an A-rated therapeutically equivalent generic. So it not only says what that the MAC rates could be disclosed, but what is subject to MAC provisions. And that's a narrower definition than what pharmacists are able to dispense.
We'll take a look at that. Good. Yes. Now, who's next?
Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Peter Hardy. I'm here on behalf of CVS Caremark, a PBM. I've submitted written testimony in opposition to all three substantive sections of this bill, but I'm only going to address one, which is the registration of the Board of Pharmacy in my oral comments. 3 points.
Please, all of you, make sure you submit written testimony to help us understand what's going on. That'd be good.
The three basic points to make. First of all, the comment about falling within the purview of the Board of Pharmacy. I would agree with that to some extent, and that's the extent that we actually practice pharmacy or have subsidiaries that provide mail service pharmacy from out of state. Oregon actually has one of the more stringent requirements for out-of-state pharmacies, and that not only do you require licensure of the out-of-state pharmacy by the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, but you also require that the pharmacist in charge, the PIC, also be licensed by the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy. So you not only have jurisdiction over the entity, but you have jurisdiction over a pharmacist who's practicing there. We think that that's appropriate, but we do not think that the Board of Pharmacy should regulate the PBM practices, the additional services that we provide for our clients and for the members. In Mississippi, the Federal Trade Commission submitted a letter to the legislature when they were considering a similar bill, where they pointed out that having market participants actually regulate other participants in that same marketplace could present antitrust concerns. And pharmacies contract with us; they are also competitors of the mail service pharmacies, and therefore therefore be inappropriate for them to be regulating us. And final point, there's more to it than just licensure and a fee. You have an uncapped surety bond. You have the ability to suspend a license without any due process on a subjective standard of conduct, quote, likely to mislead, deceive, or defraud the public or the board, which we think is inappropriate to be subject to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Chairman Greenlick and members, my name is Cindy Laubacher. I'm Senior Director.
Yeah, okay.
You did fine. Senior Director of State Government Affairs for Express Scripts. We also did submit testimony in opposition to all parts of this bill, but I'm here to speak only on the issue of pharmacy audits. We're particularly concerned with Section 3 because we believe it creates impediments to a plan sponsor's ability to recover overpayments to pharmacies. The true goal of an audit is to prevent fraudulent claims submissions from occurring. PBMs perform both desk audits, and we perform what are called on-site audits of retail and community pharmacies. Desk audits are daily claims analyses, and on-site audits are whereby we go into a pharmacy and conduct and evaluate claims against pharmacy prescription records. Together, this provides us with a consistent and timely and accurate approach to managing our plan for our plan sponsors. I'll speak to one issue in particular raised, and that is the proponents claim that this legislation doesn't apply in cases of fraud, and yet the bill is filled with impediments to even getting to the point where we could determine if fraud exists. For example, there's a limit on the number of prescriptions we can look at. There's provisions around limiting the time frames that we can go in and dates when we can go in and do an audit. We have to provide over 2 weeks' notice, which gives the bad actors out there, and I'm sure there are none in Oregon, but they do exist out there, who literally will, you know, close up shop and disappear. So we have concerns around time frames. It limits our ability to recoup overpayments, and that's really what this is about. This audits are about recouping overpayments made by our plan sponsors, whether it's a health plan, a union trust, a state employee plan, recovering those overpayments for our clients. This isn't money for us. And with that, I'll thank you and happy to answer questions.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate this. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is for the two folks from the two companies. So how, between your two companies, how many, how much of the population do you think you represent in Oregon of covered lives?
Representative Clem and Chairman Greenlick, Express Scripts represents, as I understand it, approximately 170,000 Oregonians.
And Representative Clem, Chair Greenlick, I don't know that answer, the answer to that question. I know that we managed about 10 million prescriptions, but I'll get the answer to that question. I'll get back to you with that.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Clem, I'm with Regents,
right.
And we're about 300,000 Oregonians.
Follow-ups? Yeah. So one of my questions to that last point on overpayments, you said you don't manage, you don't do audits for the purpose of anything other than the plan. So is there some margin in between your rates and the plan, or if you get the money back from audit, 100% of it gets returned to the plan?
Representative,
to your customer, I guess, would be the company who's contracting with you to do the management.
Representative Clem and Chairman Greenlick, when we conduct an audit, 100% of the money goes back to our plan sponsors. They pay us on any, depending on the client plan sponsor, they determine how it is they choose to pay us for conducting the audits. It's very, very timely, very expensive process to conduct an on-site audit in particular. So plans determine how it is they choose to pay us. So they may pay Express Scripts, the company, on a, as is in the bill, on a percentage basis, but we do not pay our employees who go in and conduct the audits on a percentage basis. So there's no bounty. And that's what that language is about bounties, but we don't incentivize, we don't pay our the people conducting the audits on a percentage basis.
So
one more.
Well, you can go here for a moment if you like.
Finish.
Yeah, so you mentioned you don't think the Board of Pharmacy is appropriate for a number of reasons. Who would be our appropriate entity in Oregon to regulate these kind of activities.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Clem, I think that that's a question that we can discuss at some more length. I will say that, in all honesty, we have in other states multiple licenses with departments of insurance, which some of our activities clearly fit. You know, for instance, even here in Oregon, we have a TPA license with the Department of Insurance as one example, but not clearly not the Board of Pharmacy.
Yes.
My turn.
Brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, since I have very little time and I have three questions, please keep your answers brief.
And speak fast.
First question is, on the antitrust concerns about being regulated by the Board of Pharmacy, do you find it ironic that other pharmacies are already regulated by the Board of Pharmacy?
Chair Vinick, Representative Conger, I can give you the letter from the Federal Trade Commission, but I can't speak to...
I don't need to see it. I just don't find it a very compelling argument, given that our Oregon-located pharmacies are already regulated by the Board of Pharmacy. And so they might share your concern, but they haven't raised it.
But I agree that it's appropriate for the Board of Pharmacy to regulate pharmacies, and that's why we have the out-of-state licenses and the pharmacists in charge. It's regulating other activities that are not the practice of pharmacy.
So we can talk some other time about what activities might or might not be suitable. How many employees does Express Scripts have?
Representative Conger, Chairman Greenlick, we just completed a merger with Medco last year, so I'm not quite sure, but it's somewhere around 30,000.
Congratulations. So on the audit front, with 30,000 employees, that's a lot of resources available to conduct audits. But we just heard testimony from a small business owner who spent 200 hours dealing with an audit that produced nothing. I understand the need to be able to conduct audits, although I have to admit that sounds pretty abusive. And in particular, I hope you can understand the difference between spending 200 hours as a business owner with maybe, I don't know, three or four employees and an Express Scripts employee with nothing else to do. It could be devastating. And so as you think about your response to that, because I know you have one, what would you think about if we imposed maybe a requirement that if Express Scripts conducting the audits doesn't find a problem or isn't able to prove a problem, if we charge Express Scripts for the time spent by the small business owner complying with the audit?
Representative,
that's a rhetorical question.
We'll find something.
Chair Green, like Representative Conger, to your issue around our number of employees. So we have contracts with over approximately a little bit over 60,000 pharmacies across this country. We have we audit less than 2% of them on an annual basis. So because in part our pharmacy unit is actually quite small. So this is not, we don't spend all of our time, we don't have people who spend all of their time looking for ways to.
I'm
going to
save you trying to answer that question and say thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, sorry, one more.
We've got 15 people on the next bill.
I just don't know whether our two out-of-state guests are going to be here multiple days or just today, or that's my only concern. If you're going to be back when we have more public hearings, then I guess I can hold it.
I'm willing to commit on behalf of CVS Caremark, whether I'm here or whether Eric Douglas is here. CVS Caremark will be here at any further hearing.
And I'm absolutely.
Take long.
Sure.
Go for it.
I just would like you, I mean, I'm new to this committee, but I would like you to, and maybe you did it last session, respond to what these pharmacists are saying, that they're worried they're going to be run out of business because of the rates they're getting, and that we'll lose pharmacies all over this state in small communities. You must be worried about that, I'm sure. You're not heartless people, obviously, but what is your response to that generally?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Clem, I will speak Frankly, I'm a consultant for CVS Caremark, but I used to head government affairs for Medco before it was acquired by Express Scripts. And I can tell you that Medco, and I'm sure that that sentiment is shared by other companies as well, we want to keep these pharmacies in business for a number of reasons. We have contractual commitments to our clients in terms of how close, what percentage of their population has to live to a pharmacy, and it's very difficult in rural areas. But also, frankly, we agree as a matter of public health policy that these pharmacies need to be kept in business. Again, I'll speak to what I know from what our former company used to do. The reality of it is it's counterintuitive, but the independent pharmacies who serve underserved populations for the most part actually get a better reimbursement rate, or did get a better reimbursement rate from Medco than do chains. In order to, we understand that it's tougher for them to purchase, for instance, at bulk quantities at reduced prices. We understand that they have different operating costs, and we wanted to keep them in business. And I joke about that's one of the reasons why we went out of business and had to be sold to Express Scripts, was because we were reimbursed so much. But that was a joke, which obviously didn't go over very well. But
all right, can you finish up, please?
Thank you,
particularly.
Representative Clem, Chair Greenlick, I would also on that add that I would refer you to what's called it's an independent study, it's the Hayes study, and that they track on a twice a year, they do put out a report on community on pharmacies in the states, and you will see over time that the number of pharmacies in the state of Oregon has stayed essentially the same.
You send us a reference to that, that'd be helpful.
It's called the Hayes study, H-A-Y-E-S.
Send it to us.
Get that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to call Mark Watt and Chris Brown. Then we have a proposed OHA and pharmacy board witness. I'm going to ask them to, we'll save you, we'll get you back when we do a work session on it. That's okay. And then after this, we have Elise Brown and Jessica Adamson. So let's do it quickly.
Okay. Chair Greenlink and members of the committee, my name is Marcus Watt. I've been a pharmacist in the state of Oregon for more than 35 years. The majority of that time has been spent in retail pharmacy. I was also a member of the Oregon Board of Pharmacy from 2000 through 2008, and served two terms as board president during that time. I'm here today representing Walgreens, which has nearly 70 stores across the state and employs nearly 1,800 Oregonians. Pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs, play an integral role in our healthcare system. And similar to most industries, reasonable standards and oversight of PBMs is necessary. PBMs negotiate and manage prescription drug benefits on behalf of health plans and essentially serve as the middleman between the health plans and pharmacies. Nationally, PBMs manage over $90 billion in drug spending each year, and they do so with very little oversight at the federal level or at the Oregon level. This amendment requires PBMs to register with the Oregon Board of Pharmacy and creates reasonable PBM audit practices. Registration of PBMs at the Board of Pharmacy simply institutes a structure for oversight of the industry in the state. The state of Oregon regulates most, if not all, industries in the state, and justifiably so. Pharmacy benefit managers should also have some reasonable level of oversight within the state. We agree that pharmacy audits are a necessary part of business between pharmacies and PBMs. As of today, nearly half of all states have adopted pharmacy audit protection measures. The amendment institutes reasonable audit processes and time frames related to PBM audits for pharmacies. These sensible standards are necessary in order for pharmacies to plan appropriately for audits and maintain business operations with undue interruption or cost. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the provisions in the amendment will ultimately benefit all Oregonians who receive quality health care from Walgreens and other retail pharmacies that provide health care. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I respectfully ask for your support of House Bill 2123.
Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Chris Brown, and I'm the Vice President of Sales for Payless Drug in Portland. And I'm here speaking on behalf of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition. In the past 15 years, I've worked for a mail service pharmacy, I've worked for a PBM, Express Scripts, I've worked for Walgreens, and now I work for a long-term care pharmacy. I'm not a pharmacist myself, but I understand a lot about the business of pharmacy. And one of the things I know in studying markets and economics and working in pharmacy is that in order for buyers and sellers to get to the best price and the best outcome and increase wealth for our country and the social good, increase utility, is we need to have clarity on what those prices are. You heard Ann talk about 87% of her drugs that are generics. She can't tell you day to day what she's going to be paid on a drug. And if a PBM makes a mistake in their MAC, how would I ever catch it? They change the prices all the time. How would I know if they're not even meeting their own MAC? I can't audit that. So my view, sadly, is that the pharmacy market is broken. The people who pay for the drugs, the plan sponsors, they don't really know what the pharmacy is being paid. The pharmacy knows what they're being paid, but we don't know what the plan sponsor is paying. And you have these companies sitting in the middle who prohibit those two parties from speaking to each other, telling them how much they're going to charge you and how much I'm going to pay you. All we want is clarity on what we're going to be paid. We want simple disclosure on prices so that we can enter into contracts, perform services with a reasonable basis and a reasonable understanding that we will be paid for those services. We're not asking for more money. We're asking for clarity on what we're going to get paid. It's really simple. And it's shocking in some ways that we have to come to the legislature to have companies tell us what they're going to pay us to provide service to their members. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Can I call Jessica Adamson and Elise Brown and ask you guys to make it as quick as you can?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record.
Who's Elise?
Well, I think Mr. Shishi may be stuck in another hearing, so I apologize for that on her behalf. Last year, not me today. So I'm Jessica Adamson, here today on behalf of United Healthcare. United has 250,000 enrollees in Oregon, and on April 1st, we'll have another 41,000 through our coverage of TRICARE. We appreciate the opportunity to share our concerns in opposition to the bill as written into the Dash 1 amendments. We have just seen the Dash 2s and 3s and haven't fully gone through those yet. We look forward to seeing
The 4s.
Looking forward to seeing the 4s. We have concerns about, as many of the others have already said, about the provisions. We are willing to work with the sponsor to try and make the audit provisions better. I would say generally, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that our company we're all interdependent. The system depends on each other. We depend on local pharmacists. We depend on PBMs. It's important to us that the system work and that it all work together on a goal I think we all share, which is to reduce the cost of healthcare, which is rising at an unsustainable rate. There's great work that this group has done. We are committed to that at United, and we are concerned that this bill may not fully meet that mark, and we want to work with the bill sponsor and others to make it better. And are concerned that in its current form it does not do that. Thank you, sir, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll get you back.
Great. Thanks.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2123 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2997 and ask my two colleagues to kick us off. Can you just tell us what this is about while they're...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2997 defines licensing requirements for the direct entry midwifery and requires the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery to adopt rules and authorize the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery to investigate complaints and take disciplinary action, including suspension, revocation of license, and assessment of civil penalties.
Well, this is a long journey, and you've been the tour guides on this.
Yes, welcome to our tour.
commend you for your work and let you kick off where we're going.
All right. Well, thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. Nice to be back and visiting on a temporary reprieve from the House Education Committee and serving with you guys today. For the record, I am Julie Parrish, State Representative from House District 37. And, you know, 2 years ago, if somebody had asked me if I would be involved in a conversation about home births, I'm probably the most unlikely suspect. All of my children were born in hospitals with full-on drugs and cake at the end delivered by the folks who from the cafeteria. So birthing babies in my
cake.
Living room, angel food cake, because, of course, I'm such an angel. But birthing babies in my living room, probably not something on my to-do list with three children. And some of you know that one of my children was birthed by a member of this assembly in a hospital. So I'm an unlikely person to be here in support of a bill about midwives. But, you know, the conversations over the last couple of years trying to find ways to make sure that we have safe home birth options for families, I think is really critical. And so as an unlikely and reluctant champion of this, I'm hoping that you will give very serious consideration to House Bill 2997. This is not an easy conversation. And there are a lot of emotions, and a lot of we went through a lot of challenge trying to bring all of these folks together, wrangle them in a room. We met for about a year and some change, and it was constant conversation about how do we get to safe home births and still protect the birth freedom for mothers who choose midwifery, and particularly the licensed or the direct entry midwives, and to be able to have that safe home birth. And so I think what you're going to hear in the testimony today is that it's not necessarily a perfectly crafted bill. There are still some hang-ups even within the group of people who sat around that table. And for the record, I mean, the people who came and were dedicated to being there at all of those committees meetings that we had really did a fantastic job. And we knew it was contentious. I'd say, you know, people talk about health exchanges and CCOs and Affordable Care Act as being the most contentious conversation in healthcare, and I would argue that it's midwives and whether or not we give birth at home. So so I'm very pleased with the output.
Fluoride.
This one's right up there with that. But I'm very pleased with the work. And we know that the work is not finished. We know that not everybody's happy with the solution that's entirely been crafted. But it takes us a big first step forward into ensuring that our direct midwives are licensed, that there is room for a traditional midwife, somebody who is the birth midwife in their culture. It recognizes that as well. And again, we understand that it's not 100% perfect, but it's a big step over a long span of conversation that has been happening since long before I even had my children in this building. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my co-chair, and I was pleased to work with her, and we learned a lot about each other in the process. And so it was a great opportunity, and I'm excited to see this bill move forward.
Thank you, co-chair of the task force. Thank you, Mr. Chair and fellow members of this committee. For the record, my name is Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, and I represent House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. I, too, really, I guess enjoyed might be the word, this task force, but really feel very passionately about what we're trying to do here. I want to, first of all, recognize the co-chair, Representative Parrish. Representative Hoyle called in several times as well. And we had on our committee two direct entry midwives, Silke Akerson, who will be talking later today, Shafia Monroe. We had two slots for certified nurse midwife. That first slot was filled by Judith Rooks, who is here, and Kate Pelosi. They took turns because of their schedules. And then Monica Arce was the second slot, and she comes from the Virginia Garcia Health Clinic. We had one naturopath who also serves as a midwife, Sarah Gucci, who actually delivered Ben Cannon's children, former Representative Ben Cannon. We had two OBGYNs, Dr. Alan Hedges, and then Dr. Duncan Nielsen, who is also here today. This was supported by Sandy, our former administrator prior to Tyler, Randy Everett, who was the former director of OLA, the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, and then Holly Mercer, who took his place as now interim director of that agency. We had many guests that came on a regular basis from Oregon Medical Association, OHSU. We had several MDs, certified nurse midwives, and and direct entry midwives, as well as consumers that came to many of the meetings, and many of those people are here. We met at least seven times as a whole group and had many more smaller meetings. So there was a lot of work and put into this. As Representative Parrish said, this is a very tough issue. It's a very personal choice, and there's passion around the choice to deliver at home. For the majority, I would say, myself included, home births with qualified midwives have led to the high-quality, patient-centered, lower-cost healthcare outside of a hospital setting, which aligns with the direction of our health transformation goals. But without mandatory licensing and clear direction from the legislature, the practice of home birth care has been inconsistent, and some families have suffered devastating losses. I recognize that there are no guarantees in life, and deaths will occur in and outside of hospitals, but we need to do everything we can to prevent bad outcomes in every setting. There are many steps to ensuring access to safe, affordable home births. This bill is only one step. Other necessary components include having a strong direct entry midwifery board with the composition of board members and a governance structure that is appropriate and strong, and the right leadership under the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, which is the umbrella agency. I'm really excited that Holly Mercer has joined as interim director, and given that she was the former director of the Board of Nursing, she brings a tremendous amount of expertise to this area. We need to make sure that the board issues appropriate standards of care based on good data. Again, a recent bill in 2011 set up a system of collecting birth data. That's a really important step because any rules around scope of practice and standards of care has to be based on good data. Another component is a strong professional association as represented here by the Oregon Midwifery Council, and midwifery education programs that promote high quality education and training, collaboration with other health professions, and awareness campaigns among providers and consumers of home births. So I really want to recognize Silke Akerson for her leadership of the Oregon Midwifery Council. I think she's done a lot to bring this profession forward. We also need hospital policies that are family-centered so that women with high-risk pregnancies don't feel compelled to choose home births because of the lack of choices in the hospital. We need hospital procedures and reimbursement systems regarding emergency transport that encourages midwives to pull the trigger more quickly during prolonged labor. And I want to recognize the leadership of Dr. Duncan Nielsen in setting up emergency transport systems at Emanuel in this regard. We need to figure out financial issues, including appropriate licensing fees, so that that doesn't become a barrier to licensure. Reimbursements in the Oregon Health Plan so that we start reimbursing in the first trimester, and liability for consumer protection. Those are not addressed in this bill. This bill does not try to address all of these issues, but strives to lay the statutory framework to balance consumer access and consumer protection to ensure the availability of healthy birth options for women. It involves a lot of compromise. There are several things about this bill that I want to just point out. One is in terms of intent. We had a lot of discussion about whether low risk should be in the statute itself. That's a real trigger because who defines low risk? Certain populations like African American women say, are you going to just automatically define me as higher risk? So we tried to work around what are other ways to get at that intent, because this is consumer protection and it is critical. In the first page, line 11, one of the ways we get at that is to say, whereas mandatory licensure programs aim to improve the public safety, originally the language was, whereas mandatory licensure program improve the public safety, and we thought we can't assume that. The intent has to be their aim. Line 13, whereas the provision of health care by a direct entry midwife is a reasonable choice for a healthy pregnant woman. So I'm trying to show you some of the areas where we have tried to get around some of the real sticking points that have bogged us down in the past. May not be perfect, but I think we gave it a good try. Secondly, mandatory licensing. The guts of this bill is around mandatory licensing. A lot of the issues that we've had have come because we have been very loosely and unevenly regulated in the past. So this does require that everyone practicing direct entry midwifery gets licensed. However, it allows for certain exemptions around cultural and education. And I realize that this is a huge point of contention around this bill. Cultural and religious groups. So on page 2, what we have done to try to address this and really hope that this will help drive both providers and consumers toward choosing licensed direct entry midwives, page 2, lines 15 to 21, is that we would only allow allow exemptions for religious and cultural reasons if there's an informed consent. And starting with line 15, the informed consent as adopted by the board has to say that the person does, so this would be informed consent given to a woman when she is starting care with a direct entry midwife. And the letter has to say that the professional does not possess a professional license issued by the state, the person is not authorized to carry and administer potentially life-saving medications, that the risk of harm or death to a mother or newborn may increase as a result of the information, and that the types of midwives who are licensed by the state, so it lists alternatives, and the client will not have recourse through a complaint process. We are trying to make the informed consent as strong as possible because some of the complaints that have come to you over the years are people were confused about who's a licensed, who's an unlicensed midwife, and they didn't really realize the distinction. So we are trying to make that, we're trying to keep open the choice that people can be delivered by whom they choose, but they need to have very strong informed consent. Education. We are trying to align a lot of our practice and our educational standards for the practice of direct entry midwifery around the national and international standards that are also changing. And so we have strengthened that area. We have kept all of the previous provisions of educational requirements that were in the previous statute and called that a minimum and said that on top of that, it also has to be consistent with the requirements of becoming a certified professional midwife, CPM, as established by the NARM, the North American Registry of Midwives. There's several different things, including written and oral examination, CPR, a written plan for emergency transport, high school diploma, things that were not included in the previous statute that add to the educational requirements. Governance is another issue. The governance calls for... Okay.
16 people.
Okay, I'm sorry. Director. Okay, just trying to lay out the bones of this because I know people will respond to this. The final order in terms of rulemaking and investigations, you have the same people sitting around the table, direct entry midwives, along with the OLA, Oregon Health Licensing Agency people. Before, the Oregon Health Licensing Agency people had the final say. This shifts it to the direct entry midwifery board so that it is being treated like other professions, who have that final say. I will say that in the bill, we will do an amendment that returns the fiscal management to how it is now. So if there's any question about that, we're changing that. In closing, I just want to say that I think that we've also taken a really big step toward compromise. Again, you cannot think that the bill is going to do everything. I feel passionately about this bill. I will continue to watch it. I would love it if you want the work group to continue because I think we have a lot more work to do. And I think legislative oversight is imperative to make sure this continues in the direction that it's intended. Thank you.
I'll just add one last quick thing. Nearly 50,000 children are born in Oregon every year. We want the profession of midwifery to be robust. We want to see them included in the conversations around CCOs. We know that in other states where they have actually done studies on the reduction of healthcare costs by having a robust midwifery profession in their state, we think that that applies to Oregon. This bill doesn't address that, but we think it's a step towards addressing that as we continue to try to professionalize this practice in such a way that acknowledges and honors the fact that women have been birthing babies since before there was organized government and that we can't mitigate every risk in childbirth that just can't happen, but this gets us a step closer to a safer home birth outcome. So with that, we'll hop back up and listen to the testimony.
You guys did great. You really did a great job.
And I do want to say three people had to leave because they had to leave by 2 o'clock. So I know they submitted testimony. Dr. Stella Dances, I think her last name is. They had to get back to children.
Who the other two were?
Mary and Lonnie. I don't know the last names. But
Mary
please.
Allison and Lonnie Dozer.
Thank you. Lonnie Dozer and Mary Allison. So please do look at the testimony. I feel bad that they came all the way down here and weren't able to testify. So please.
Actually,
look.
Two of them weren't signed up.
Oh, okay. Two were supported.
Let's go.
Okay, thank you.
And please, we need to be out of here by 2:45, maybe 2:50. We get thrown out. There's another committee coming in, so please try and be brief. Let's start with Judith Rooks, Augustine Kolobolnik, maybe, Margarita Mary Buena. Almost everybody else wrote so I could read it. So,
Colebrook.
What is it?
Colebrook.
Colebrook, really?
All right.
You're kidding. Yes, ma'am. Kick us off.
Hi.
Hi, Judith.
Hello. Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and committee. I'll try to be very fast. Do you all have the table that I have? I'm sorry that everybody in the audience doesn't have it also. I'm a certified nurse midwife, past president of the American College of Nurse Midwives, a CDC-trained epidemiologist. I've published 3 major studies on out-of-hospital births in this country. In 2011, the Oregon House Healthcare Committee amended the direct entry DEM law to require collection of information on planned place of birth and birth attendant on fetal death and live birth certificates starting in 2012. As a result, Oregon now has the most complete, accurate data of any state on outcomes of planned home births and out of hospital births and births. This table, which the rest of you can't see, I regret, summarizes that data for 2012. The first row, you see that 9 babies died during or soon after labor in homes or birth centers in 2012. The total mortality rate for planned out-of-hospital births was 4.5 per 1,000 births, which is shown in the last box in that row. I gave the number of neonatal deaths, both with and without the death of one baby who died of congenital anomalies. That death cannot be attributed to the care provided by the direct entry midwife. The second row shows data on only births for which direct entry midwives were the planned attendants. The total mortality rate, excluding the one with congenital anomalies, was 4.8 deaths per 1,000 births. For comparison, data on births planned to occur in hospitals is provided in the bottom row of the table. The total mortality rate for births planned to be attended by direct entry midwives is 6 to 8 times higher than the rate for births planned to be attended in hospitals. The data for hospital births does not exclude deaths caused by congenital anomalies, so the difference is actually greater. Many women have been told that out-of-hospital births are safer than births in hospitals, and that is true in some places, but not in Oregon, where many are attended by birth attendants who have not completed an educational curriculum designed to provide all of the knowledge, skills, and judgment required by midwives, regardless of the setting in which they practice. Most women who have out-of-hospital births with direct entry midwives are very happy, support them strongly, and many will contact their legislators to argue that DEMS don't need more education or regulation. Oregon needs more direct entry midwives. More and more women want out-of-hospital births. And they want direct entry midwives.
Would you please wrap it up?
Yes. Many are excellent, but the floor is too low. Some are not safe enough. In 2012, 6 Oregon mothers lost their babies in births attended by DEMS. They may feel guilty about having chosen a home birth, and they're unlikely to contact you. The more than 1,000 women who had good outcomes and are happy are the ones who will contact you.
Thank you
legislature
very much.
Won't have...
I appreciate that. Next week, that's 4 minutes, right?
Thank you.
Please.
Co-Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing my testimony today to address a very important issue for women and children of our state. My name is Augustine Colebrook. I'm a nationally certified and Oregon State licensed midwife in practice for 10 years. I practice in Southern Oregon, offering families the option to deliver their babies in one of two Oregon licensed birth centers that I own and operate, or in their own homes within a 20-minute radius of the I-5 corridor. My group practice, comprised of CPMs and CNMs, is committed to providing compassionate, evidence-based care with true informed decision-making by the women we serve. We strive to offer low-risk families the highest quality care available with thorough risk assessment and appropriate referral or transfer when necessary. I am passionately supportive of House Bill 2997, not only because it establishes an excellent standard of care for out-of-hospital providers, but also assures the public that the midwife that they hire has current and relevant skills to safely serve at out-of-hospital births. Professionalism by midwives is demonstrated by culturally competent, evidence-based, individualized care. The women of Oregon deserve nothing best than what we can give. I feel confident that this bill requiring mandatory licensure for midwives will be giving women choice in birth location and provider without sacrificing safety or quality of care. I'm especially pleased to see that in addition to our current legend drugs, prescriptive authority of postpartum antihemorrhagic, Rogam, epinephrine, IV fluids, local anesthetic, and oxygen, we have the addition of group B streptococcal antibiotic prophylaxis and tocolytics included. These two legend drugs being added to the bill further protect women's safety when giving birth with licensed midwives. I humbly suggest that the addition of antifungals to treat breastfeeding infections should be added. These simple additions to our formulary will decrease a woman's risk of going untreated, thereby endangering herself or her baby, as well as decrease the frustration and challenge present for a woman who needs to seek prescriptions from providers not present in her care just to be able to be treat using the community standard of care. Midwifery standards of care that are consistent with the community standard are what ensure safety for women and babies. It is our duty to offer an initial education and a continuing education
Please
for midwives that confers competency in all out-of-hospital maternity care skills. Thank you. I've submitted my testimony as well.
Great. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and the rest of the committee. I thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify in front of you, and I also thank those who are hard at work to create House Bill 2997.
Please introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Margarita Maraboyna, and I lost my son in July 2011 at Eugene home birth. I chose an unlicensed midwife. This is my son right here. I chose an unlicensed midwife because I knew that the state of Oregon did not require licensing. I thought that I chose competent midwives. Unfortunately, they failed me and my son. I support mandatory licensing in the state of Oregon. However, I do see that there are several issues with the bill, one of which is the exclusion for traditional midwives, which I feel is a loophole that the midwives I had or any other midwives that are not educated enough or equipped to handle situations like mine could get through. And I just want to show this picture of what happened to my son. My midwives thought this was completely normal. He was covered in meconium. I delivered 2 days after my water broke. And this is what I fear will happen with that traditional midwife clause. I, again, support mandatory midwifery, and I understand the position where you can't make everybody happy with this bill, but my son was perfectly healthy. He died a preventable death, and I just urge you guys to consider my story and those of other women here in Oregon. I know that those opposing midwifery will say that women will be left to birth at home by themselves. I would never have chosen that. I chose midwives who I thought were able to handle my birth. I was never considered high risk, but then again, we go back to the low risk. You know, I think that if an OB would have looked at my situation, they would have probably said I was high risk. The midwives, of course, said I was low risk and not a problem. So thank you for this time, and I look forward to seeing how this progresses.
Thank you very much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you for coming and sharing.
Before I call the next one, let me say what's on my mind. We're going to schedule a work session where we have some time to talk among ourselves. So we'll get a chance to hear. We'll ask Holly to join us to talk about it, and we'll ask you guys to come you to come back, and we'll spend some time talking and getting more information about it. So we'll try and get through the testimony so everybody has a chance, and then spend some time together. We have Roger Peltola, Silke Akerson, and Heather Johnson, please. Yeah, we can have some real conversation.
My name is Heather Johnson. I'm a doula and a nurse midwifery student at OHSU. And first of all, I want to thank everyone who's worked so hard on this bill, and especially Chair Greenlich and the committee for considering the bill and listening to our testimony today. And I also want to say that I myself was born at home in Oregon, and I absolutely support home birth under the right circumstances. The reason that I'm here today is because of something that happened to a dear friend of mine. In 2009, she lost her grandson, Henry, due to the negligence of a home birth midwife. Not only was this midwife responsible for Henry's death, but 7 months later, she was also responsible for the serious injury of a mother and a second preventable infant death. In both cases, this midwife attended the labor in the state of Washington, but transferred the mother in crisis to a hospital in Oregon. This midwife is licensed in the state of Washington, but because of these two cases, she has been placed on a strict supervised probation for 4 years. However, she continues to practice here in Oregon with no restrictions or oversight. Unfortunately, this is not an isolated case, and because of this, I'm a strong supporter of mandatory licensing. I'm not, however, a supporter of the bill as it is currently written. I don't believe that there should be an exclusion of licensing for any profession whose members could cause bodily injury or loss of life as a result of inadequate training or refusal to practice safely just because of a cultural bias or a belief system. I would not object to allowing traditional birth attendants to practice as long as they are not calling themselves midwives, because myself and women considering hiring someone to attend their home birth, the word midwife indicates a certain level of education and proficiency. Additionally, the bill currently calls for expansion of the responsibilities of the Board of Direct Entry Midwifery to rulemaking and investigation. I don't believe that either of those things are in the best interests of women seeking to have a home birth in Oregon. Since midwives were first allowed to be licensed here in 1993, the board has systematically loosened the absolute risk criteria for licensed midwives. And I can only imagine this would continue if they had full control over the rulemaking. Additionally, it's already difficult enough for families who have been affected by poor midwifery care to submit a complaint. And in fact, several I know have complained that they have not been taken seriously by the subject matter experts assigned to their cases, and that it has taken years for the board to issue final orders. So I want to thank you all for considering this bill and for listening to my testimony today. And I ask that you will first take into account what is best for mothers and babies when you consider this bill.
Thank you so much.
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, I'm Silke Akerson. I'm the president of the Oregon Midwifery Council. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I just want to acknowledge the huge amount of work that went into this bill on the part of Representative Parrish and Representative Kenny Geyer and everyone else on the work group. And I think what we're going to hear today and throughout the session is that there are people who feel that the bill doesn't go far enough in protecting the public safety, and there are people who feel that the bill doesn't go far enough in protecting the freedoms of birthing families in Oregon. And I think that this bill is a wise and reasonable middle path for where we are now. For the conditions that we're working in now. And I want to, my written testimony is much longer, but today I'm just going to talk about the concerns around safety, because the reason that we came to this table, the table again, and revisited our position on mandatory licensure is because there have been these concerns about safety. You know, by and large, we know that home birth midwifery care with low-risk women is safe, but we've seen in Oregon that there have been a series of cases where it hasn't gone well, and we take that very seriously. The Oregon Midwifery Council has revisited policies around chart review, around quality assurance, around continuing education, and we're working very hard in the capacity as the professional organization to improve the standard of care. My view is that the legislature has a limited role, and that role is in creating a clear
sustainable statute that supports the board and the professional organization in improving the safety and quality of care. And that's why I think that this bill is so good. It's very important that the people who are experts in midwifery care have the final say in rulemaking and in investigation, not because we want to be protectionist. It breaks my heart how long some of the investigations have been in the queue, but that's not because the board is trying to stall them. That's because of factors that have been well outside of our control, changes in OHLA, changes in other things. The members of the board would very much like to be able to clinically look at a case and say, this was an urgent case that had caused grievous harm, and we want to bring this case to the front of the investigation system. I would love it if you guys wanted to ask me more questions later or wanted to have meetings, because obviously I have a lot more detail to say about that. But I thank you, and I hope you support this bill. Yes.
Good.
I hope you support this bill. I think it's amazing.
Thank you very much. We have Stacy Westover, Linda Glenn, and Duncan Nielsen. You're hiding?
Yeah.
Hiding. Go ahead, please.
Okay, again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. I concur pretty much with what everybody's saying, is this is complicated. I am a nurse midwife.
Please introduce yourself.
I work in a hospital setting.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, Linda Glenn. And I also have a home birth practice and have done out-of-hospital births for greater than 20 years. I also have served on a number of different licensing boards that involve investigation, including the Board of Midwifery in Oregon. I am in support of this bill. I do not think it's perfect, as our two representatives have said, but I do think a lot of work has been done to move it forward in the interest of not having these bad outcomes. I also would like to say that I have seen a huge change in my observations of the way cases are handled, with the board being much more aware of the problems and being willing to address those. And so I do think that they need to be able to be directly responsible. If they are not directly responsible, they cannot be held directly accountable. Thank you.
Thank you.
One other thing, we do need Group B strip prophylaxis privileges for people, because a lot of women are choosing not to be treated. And there is one area that is a deficit in the bill where you give intention. It does not include the idea of standards of practice, and I would like that added.
Thank you. Yes.
Hi. My name is Stacy Westover. Thank you for working so hard on this bill. I'm here today because I care about babies and women's health and the families that love them. I do support a woman's right to choose the location of their child's birth and their attendant, but I support mandatory licensure of all midwives. Right now, anyone can call themselves a midwife. They don't need any training or anything, and then they can charge a fee and attend a birth. I think that is very scary. What I've been hearing a lot is about freedom. Nobody's saying that they want to take the choice away from a mom to have a home birth, but we have midwives, certified nurse midwives, so it's not that people are against home birth. We've had a lot of bad outcomes, and a lot of these aren't showing up in the vital statistics. One friend of mine who was unwilling to be here had to have three surgeries, I don't even want to say it. She had to have three surgeries, including complete hysterectomy, to fix her reproductive system after having her birth with a direct entry midwife. And another family has a child that has severe cerebral palsy. He will never walk. He's not going to talk. He can't do anything. And these things don't show up in the vital statistics as bad as they are. Licensing is absolutely necessary. When I found out that anybody could just become a midwife in this state, I was actually pretty surprised. I can't imagine that this is a safe way to provide health care. I guess that's it.
Thank you very much. Dr. Nielsen?
Yes, Representative Greenlake and members of this committee. My name is Duncan Nielsen. I'm an OBGYN physician practicing in Portland since 1974. And in the year 2007, I took a position with Legacy Health System as the chief of women's services and have worked for program development in women's services since that time. I've been very interested in outreach to the home birth community, trying to facilitate transfer of patients, timely transfer for patients who need that, and to get rid of the barriers that I think have contributed to the lack of safety. I was privileged to be a member of the work group developing this bill, and I'm absolutely convinced that we've heard as much as we could possibly hear and process for the varied opinions and emotionally held points of view, all of which we all have, regarding this particular subject. And I firmly believe that this bill, while may not be perfect, is as good as we can do. Perfection may be the enemy of the good here if we push that too far. What this bill does is it addresses the inconsistencies in practice that we now face in the state of Oregon among multiple different direct entry midwifery providers, and it does so in the way that other professional organizations have, by requiring mandatory licensure and by empowering the board of direct entry midwifery to set standards of practice and education and be able to enforce them. These standards are linked to national standards, which in turn are linked to international standards, where we actually have a great deal more data to confirm the safety of that approach. I do believe that there is no way we can get around the need for a safety valve for to cover traditional societies or cultures that we do not understand or even recognize. They kind of come up. I'm not enough of a cultural anthropologist to be able to tell you about them all, but I do know they're there, and that's why the bill came out in this particular form. I do strongly support this bill. I do not do home births. I have not been an active proponent of home birth, but from my role in oversight, I actually oversee approximately 6,000 deliveries a year. I feel this bill is very important and very necessary, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
May I ask the doctor one other question, quickly?
Yes, very quickly.
There was discussion about getting an earlier intervention to get to the hospital if there were complications. Is that addressed adequately, do you think?
It's mentioned. It's sort of hard to know how to do that.
Yeah.
It's a complex and a largely cultural issue. You heard testimony earlier about a particular midwife who bypassed hospitals in one state to go to another state because of these particular issues. Fighting that isn't straightforward, and I don't believe the bill can actually legislate how that's done, but it is referenced as one of the goals of the bill.
So the board can propagate rules.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Can we have Liz Baer, Jessica Dolan, and it looks like Care Dolan?
Carrie.
Is it Care?
It's Carrie.
Oh, Karen.
Carrie.
K-A-I-R-E. And the last?
Dolan.
Why don't you start since I butchered your name?
Okay. My name is wait for the green light. Hi. My name is Carrie Downing, and thank you so much for all the hard work that you and the committee has put together for this bill. I am not in support of this bill because of several reasons. One is that it doesn't address the many, many things that have been already spoken about today. And I think that the idea of licensing midwives, it does not make the public more safe. The United States is number 42 in all of the world for maternal mortality, and with only 1% of home births and midwife-attended births happening in the United States, I don't think that that high rate is because of midwifery care. I also believe that women have the right to choose, and they also have the responsibility to make sure that the person that they choose is adequately trained and experienced in what services that they're looking for. I wrote something, but after what everybody else has said, it's become very hard for me to go with my original plan.
Would you like to send it to us?
Sorry?
You could send us.
I would. But I also want to point out that babies and mothers die and get injured every day in hospitals, and we don't hear about that on the news. We don't hear about that in the newspapers. And most of those women aren't here to talk about their unnecessary cesareans, which is why women are seeking midwifery care, because they don't want to go to the hospital. They don't want to have the cascade of interventions that are standard practice that lead to all of these unnecessary cesareans, where we are almost at a 40% rate of cesareans in almost all the hospitals in the state of Oregon. That's why women are trying to choose other options. They don't want to go. They don't want cesareans. They don't want their babies taken away from them. And there are many, many other ways that parents and babies are injured at birth that are long-lasting. And I'd like to make sure that those things are also considered, not just the couple of unfortunate incidents that have happened. So thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
I'm Jessica Dolan. I was born at home in the 70s in Washington County. I've been attending births for more than a decade, and I've been a licensed midwife for the last 8 years. I have reserved support for this bill. I want to make sure that we have a bill that preserves the rights of families to make personal decisions while at the same time provides good education for people to make those decisions with, and that we have qualified practitioners with strong education on their side. In the interest of time, I'm going to submit further testimony in writing and just want to thank everyone for all their hard work on finding a middle ground that everyone can be at least equally unhappy with.
That's a perfect bill, the one that everybody hates.
Hi, I'm Liz Baer. I have 5 children who are all born with different types of midwives. I've covered all of the settings that you can give birth except the OR. I've had a baby in a hospital, 2 in birth centers, and 2 at home. One at home with my midwife there and 1 with her on the way. It wasn't her fault. I called her too late. But the birth story that I want to tell you is my 4th baby. Somebody previously who spoke had mentioned using nurse midwives for home birth, and I tried to do that when I lived in Maryland. In Maryland, you can only be a nurse midwife to attend a home birth. So I had a nurse midwife. I saw her for all of my prenatal care, and at 38 weeks, she let me know that I had been risked out of her protocols because my hemoglobin, went below 10. It was 9.9. Here in Oregon, the standards are that it can get down to 9, and then the licensed midwives have to risk you out. But because it was a different state with a different set of standards, what she told me two weeks before I was due and the week before I had my baby was that she couldn't attend my birth at home. I let her know that, you know, even though she had hospital privileges, I wouldn't be coming, and that I was going to try to find someone else, but that I would stay home regardless. I was lucky to find a CPM in my state who wasn't licensed to work in my state but lived nearby.
CPM, certified professional midwife,
who, you know, would be allowed to practice here but isn't in Maryland. And she attended my birth at possible cost to herself because she wasn't licensed there. The birth went fine. I was fine. The baby was fine. But I would have stayed at home anyway. And my concern about the bill here is that if it does anything to reduce the number of midwives, that there will be women who will stay at home anyway, because I would. And, you know, that if we raise, we talk about the bar for safety, but if we raise the bar for licensing and for making midwives available, that there could be poor outcomes because of women like me who will be obstinate and not go to the hospital. I guess that kind of covers it.
Thank you very much. I think we have 2 more. Rebecca Grancontra and Linda Bennett. Did I miss anybody on the list? I don't think I did. Go for it.
Hello, Representative Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Rencounter, and I'm here to put my face on a happy home birth with a licensed and unlicensed midwife 1 year ago in a month. I had a great experience. It was important to me to have both of those types of midwives attending my birth. I don't know if I'm in a place where I wouldn't go to the hospital, but I would have a lot of fear that I think would affect my birth experience. Because I gave birth at home, I feel like I'm a new person. I don't have anything to compare it to. It was my only child that I've ever had. But I just
it was really important for the health of myself and my family, and I just wanted to speak to that today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming.
You'd be able to do it in that time.
You got to follow that.
I know, I do. My name's Linda Bennett. It's hard to figure out how to introduce myself. Woman, mother, grandmother, and former unlicensed midwife. Okay? And Oregonian. Very proud to be an Oregonian. So, this is really hard. This is simple on one level and very difficult on another level. The difficulty is that nobody wants to say that this woman doesn't have a choice to deliver with whom and where she chooses and in a manner that she chooses. But when Representative Greenlick said that one of his goals as he finished his term was to criminalize the unlicensed practice of midwifery, that's where I feel like I have to stand up. Other states, 27 states, do not have laws that criminalize the unlicensed practice of either a traditional birth attendant or an unlicensed midwife. So you're in good company that way. You're in also good company in that you have a decent licensing law. The trick is to get more midwives to get licensed and to make that opportunity available to more people and to make birthing options in the hospital as well as out of the hospital more available. There are four counties in Oregon where the only births registered by Vital Statistics were home births. There's no hospital there. If you criminalize the unlicensed practice of midwifery, you'll have a situation like California, where the prosecution of an unlicensed midwife becomes a political decision made by the district attorney based on the politics of the area. So if you live in a coastal Northern California community, you'll have a situation like I did and my fellow midwives who were arrested for practicing medicine without a license before there was a law available. And when the DA realized that there was an immense amount of support in the community for the accessibility of midwives, he decided when he had the chance, when things died down a year or so later and it was still going through the courts, he dropped all the charges against us. Or you have, and then he ran for judge and won. So when you have a Los Angeles County District Attorney currently who wants to run for further office, maybe gubernatorial, he's making hay right now, and one of the ways is by finding somebody who's been a midwife for years, who for some reason comes to the attention of the paramedics appropriately, usually, and decides to prosecute. This is what criminalizing the unlicensed practice of midwifery actually, practically does. It does not in itself protect midwives. It does not in itself increase the access to good birth choices. I love the informed consent part in here. I want you to rewrite it and make it law for obstetricians. Over half, more than 50% of the hospitals in the state of Oregon have banned vaginal birth. Sincerely, if you put it that way, it's shocking. Have banned vaginal birth if you have a scar on your uterus from a previous section. Where's the informed consent in that process? But you've done a great amount of work. I'd like to see how this goes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, short enough?
It was just perfect. Thank you. And we ended just on time, and I hope everybody got a chance. I'm sorry that I had to squeeze you all down. I guess I would like to suggest I didn't say it exactly in that way, but we're going to have some time on this. We're going to have some amendments. We're going to have some things before us. We'll have a chance for us to discuss it as a committee with maybe a couple of experts to help us. Again, you guys did a great job.
Unbelievable.
We're going to close the public hearing.
Really good.
And we are adjourned.
Really good.
Got some comments for yesterday.